From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan sets a new record in the number of opioid-related overdose deaths.
The drugs are getting stronger. We see an influx of fentanyl coming in now, and those are deadly and can be deadly the first time they're used.
Plus, automakers and tech companies teaming up in the race to get an autonomous vehicle into the marketplace and onto the road.
Can the auto industry learn from Silicon Valley, which tends to be much more driven by innovation, much less fear of failure, learn from failure?
Answering your questions about water filters and PFAS chemicals.
The way these work is that the chemicals in the drinking water would rather attach to the filter than stay in the drinking water.
And reintroducing a dinosaur fish to the Maumee River. Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Opioid-related overdose deaths have hit a new high in Michigan. That's the takeaway from numbers released today by the State Department of Health and Human Services. Judge Linda Davis sits on the bench of the 41B District Court in Macomb County, and she is the president of Families Against Narcotics. Judge Davis, in 2015, slightly more than 1,300 opioid-related deaths in Michigan, and last year the number up to 1,941, and that is a new record. Does this surprise you?
No, it doesn't. I've actually predicted that this is probably going to be an increasing number for at least the next 4 to 5 years. You have to look at the number of opiates that were prescribed over the past 15 to 20 years and the number of people that are addicted to that. And now that we are restricting the amount that doctors can write and trying to get that back under control, we still have a huge population that is already addicted, and we don't have the treatment beds available to treat those people. So they are turning to illicit drugs. The drugs are getting stronger. We see an influx of fentanyl coming in now, and those are deadly and can be deadly the first time they're used. So I think until we get all of those things in place, that number is going to continue to rise.
And I know we should make a point that some of that increase is because the state adopted a newer definition in defining opioid deaths. But for those of you in the community of trying to fight this problem in our state, this must be just, what are the feelings you have as you see these numbers?
Well, the numbers are very disheartening, and I talk about that all the time, that I sometimes feel like I'm beating my head against the wall with trying to change what's going on in our state with addiction. But I do see so many good things that are coming out of it. I really do think that people are more educated now about what addiction is. We're starting to change the face of addiction, and we're really beginning to destigmatize it, which means that in the future, better treatment will be available. We're also looking at things like how is treatment done and realizing that we really haven't changed the way addiction has been treated for the last 50 to 75 years. And so now we're coming up with new medications that can treat opiate addiction, that can treat alcoholism. And as we come up with these new ways of treating people and understanding that this is a chronic illness, it's a disease, and we should be treating it like that, I believe that unfortunately a lot of people have had to die to get us there. But I think we're on the right road to coming up with a system of recovery and treatment that will really work.
And I know in 2017, Michigan made it easier for pharmacists to be able to distribute naloxone, Narcan, that can reverse an opioid overdose. And we've always heard all along, getting Narcan into the hands of friends and family to have it there makes a difference. Do you think we're seeing that begin to make a difference in Michigan?
I know we are. One of our local communities had 9 overdoses last month and only 1 death as a result of that. Without Narcan, all 9 of those could have been deaths. So it definitely is helping. We are in the process right now with Families Against Narcotics of doing Narcan training for families and friends, for police officers. We train business people. Overdoses can happen in the bathroom at your local business. And so schools, local businesses, and particularly families. And we don't think about senior citizens, but so many of them are prescribed narcotics for hip surgeries and pain-related issues, that if you are on an opiate medication, the risk for accidental overdose is huge. An elderly person who forgets they took their medication and takes a second pill could be at risk. It stops their heart. And so it's a precautionary thing. It doesn't always mean that the person is an addict even, but these drugs are safeguards against accidental overdose.
Judge Davis, how are we doing in physician education?
It is getting better. For the first time, we are starting to see a decline in the amount of opiates that are being written. I do a lot of education for doctors and families against narcotics, partners with a lot of hospitals to do that. And I will tell you that the physicians take a real hit for creating this epidemic, and they certainly bear a big responsibility on that. But I want to make it clear that we don't think that was done intentionally, at least not by most doctors. Most doctors, once they realize what the problem is and what their prescribing tendencies have caused with their patients, are more than willing to decrease the amounts that they're writing. And in some instances, are not writing at all and just referred to a pain management clinic that is better able to deal with pain in an appropriate way. What our fear is, though, is that because of the new guidelines, that doctors will stop treating people that are already addicted to these drugs. And there is a lot of help out there to help them move to the next level of not just abandoning those patients, but actually offering them real viable help to get them into treatment.
This is a good time for us to note that Families Against Narcotics has 21 chapters around Michigan, correct? I checked the website.
We do.
And you can go to familiesagainstnarcotics.org, and you'll find all kinds of information about locations, meetings, and the many resources that Families Against Narcotics offers to people in Michigan. Judge Linda Davis is the president of Families Against Narcotics. Thank you so much, Judge Davis.
Thank you for having me.
Ancient history comes alive Saturday in the Maumee River. And by ancient, we're talking Jurassic, perhaps as far back as the Triassic era, some 200 million years ago when dinosaurs ruled the Earth. Saturday is when conservationists will release around 3,000 baby sturgeon into the Maumee River, hoping to revive the species' once huge Lake Erie population. Kent Becker is director of conservation and research at the Toledo Zoo. Kent, the sturgeon is a dinosaur fish?
It certainly is. It's one of the more ancient fishes.
And how long has it been on the Earth?
So, as you said in the intro there, it probably dates back to the dinosaur era.
And what's its life cycle?
So, sturgeon in general, and the lake sturgeon, the species that we're talking about specifically, is a very long-lived fish. So we're talking a fish that, you know, could probably go 100 years. And what's interesting about that is they take a long time to reach maturity also, probably 15 to 20 years before they're even reproducing. And then at that point, they reproduce very infrequently. So what we have is a very unique fish species that is categorized by long life and very low recruitment, that is young surviving to replace the adult. So I think that's a lot of the reason why they went extinct in the Maumee River years ago, because of those life history traits. They're unfortunately easy to harvest to extinction.
And they used to be pretty abundant, didn't they, in Lake Erie and in the tributaries around Lake Erie. What happened?
So Lake Erie as a whole at one point had 19 reproducing populations of lake sturgeon. And lake sturgeon, like many of our fish, swim upriver to spawn and would spawn in these river tributaries. Now we know that the Lake Erie lake sturgeon are only present from two reproducing populations, the St. Clair-Detroit River side and the Niagara side. So occasionally lake sturgeons still do show up in Lake Erie from one of those populations, but we don't have any of the other reproducing populations that once kept Lake Erie so full of lake sturgeon. And I was impressed when I looked back through some of the literature. The largest harvest of lake sturgeon was in 1885, and it's incredible to think of the sheer number of these incredibly large fish that once occurred in Lake Erie that are much reduced and absent from much of the reproducing population that they once occurred in.
Were they fished out of existence? Did man help speed that extinction in Lake Erie?
all indications indicate that that is the case. So basically, years ago, sturgeon were just harvested as trash fish. They were a problem while we were fishing for other fish species, and they were just discarded. Shortly after that, humans realized that they were so oily that they could actually be burned for fuel. And then in Europe, the Russian market of caviar began to crash because those species of sturgeon have similar life history traits. So then we realized there's value to these sturgeon in meat products and egg products. So all of those insults to their population have basically rendered what we have today, which is much fewer populations of them in Lake Erie than we should, and none here in Ohio where this project's taking place.
And Kent, you alluded to the size of Mr. Sturgeon. What will Mr. Sturgeon look like when he's all big and grown up?
These are really impressive fish. I think a lot of people see them as very charismatic fish. One is because of their size. They certainly are large fish. I mean, you can talk 6 foot to 8 foot fish, could probably approach 150 to 200 pounds in some circumstances. They've got the barbels that hang below their mouth. They've got a unique snout. They're covered with these bony plates. So they really do kind of live up to that fish of the dinosaur era. And I think all of those things together just make them kind of an endearing fish for most of the population.
So 3,000 baby sturgeon are being released into the mommy this Saturday. And then what?
Well, this is a very unique project that's been a long time in the making and a lot of partners involved in this. So what makes our project kind of unique is actually 50% of the fish that are being released are going to actually come from a fish hatchery in Genoa, Wisconsin, run by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So the idea is in future years, our other partners, Ohio Division of Wildlife, USGS, and many others are going to actually be able to look at whether more fish are coming from the hatchery or more fish from the streamside facility that's operating here at the Toledo Zoo, and allow for some comparisons between those things. So to answer your question, hopefully, in 10 to 20 years, we will see sturgeon spawning again in the Maumee River, and that's the ultimate hope of this project.
Kent, how does it feel personally, you're the director of conservation at the Toledo Zoo, how does it feel to play a key role, number one, in reviving a dinosaur species in 2018, and number two, knowing those babies are going to live long after you, me, and everyone listening to us?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Toledo Zoo is involved in a lot of conservation efforts. So we work with Ohio Division of Wildlife to recover hellbenders in Ohio. We have some butterfly projects. But most of the other species that were directly involved in the recovery of those species in the wild are a much different life history trait, I think. So what you alluded to is something that's kind of hit all the staff members that have been involved in this, is that this is a project that's probably going to extend into my retirement.
And perhaps beyond.
Perhaps.
Kent Becker is the Director of Conservation and Research at the Toledo Zoo, part of the effort releasing baby sturgeon into the Maumee River and bringing it back to the Jurassic era. Kent, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From the very birth of the auto industry, it's been all about competition, beating other companies, being proprietary, keeping breakthroughs top secret to get competitive advantage. But now competition is giving way to co-opetition. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, what is co-opetition and why is it so important to the global auto industry?
Well, I think the industry is facing a fundamental shift into autonomy and electrification and mobility. It's being driven, we've talked about this many times before, being driven by a lot of external forces, by Chinese regulators, by technology. And I think one of the things that we're starting to see develop very clearly is that this is not just a Detroit versus Silicon Valley kind of battle. Increasingly, we're seeing the auto industry partnering with tech companies, either their startups or more established companies, to develop the technologies and to move forward. Now, this week, we're seeing another wrinkle here where we're seeing a Detroit automaker, General Motors, that already is partnered with Cruise Automation, which is an autonomous vehicle company out of San Francisco. They essentially own most of it, if not all of it at this point. They are now partnering with Honda. So now you have two OEMs and two automakers with global reach, with real technical credibility and capability, coming together to develop a from the ground up autonomous vehicle with their AV partner. It's very unusual. It's new, I think. It's a new twist in all this, but I think it's an indication of where we're headed.
And so what does General Motors get from Honda with this? And what does Honda get from being tied in now with General Motors and in its GM Cruise?
Obviously, they're going to be exchanging a lot of technology. General Motors is going to be producing the vehicle. Honda will be working with Cruise on a lot of the interiors of the vehicle and bringing some of its specialty at miniaturization, packaging in smaller vehicles, things like that. And I think their view is it's a win-win, and I think it really signifies where they're headed here and where the market is here. I think what they're looking at are China, and they're looking at the United States as two critical markets where they are both strong.
And give us some examples, as you do in your column today, of where we've got our OEMs, our automakers, partnering up with these upstart techie companies.
You've got Ford Motor Company has bought a majority stake in a company called Argo AI, which is technically based in Pittsburgh, but has a huge operation in Dearborn that I happened to visit not too long ago. And the two guys running that, one is an alum of Google in its self-driving car project, and the other is from Uber. Fiat Chrysler is partnered with Waymo, which is the self-driving car project of Google. They're moving down the road and pretty aggressive. General Motors with Cruise. The Germans tend to be working more on their own. Toyota has made an investment with Uber to develop more self-driving vehicles. So I think everybody is moving in this direction, and nobody is saying, hey, we can do it all. And historically, as you point out at the top, these companies have always tried to do it all. And in the traditional auto space, they were better equipped to do that. I think now you have these two industries are looking at this convergence of essentially IT and the automobile and saying none of us really have the capability to do it all from the beginning to the end.
So we can each teach the other.
Right, which I think then that's the next level here. And the next level is the cultural challenge here. Can the auto industry learn from Silicon Valley, which tends to be much more driven by innovation, much less fear of failure, learn from failure? But on the other hand, the auto industry is a very highly regulated industry. It makes one of the most highly regulated consumer products probably in the United States, if not the whole world. And it lives in a legal environment, in a regulatory environment, which they really don't in Silicon Valley. In fact, any talk of just the lightest bit of regulation sends them into a swivet out there in Silicon Valley. So they have a lot they can learn from each other culturally. The auto industry needs to move more quickly, needs to be more innovative, needs to understand that because it has so much legacy, a century of legacy, in some ways it may just need to jump totally over that legacy as opposed to trying to push the change through the system that they have that's existing. So I think what you see is in GM buying Cruise and in Ford buying Argo, those are two examples of saying, we can't push this through our system. We're going to jump over the system and go buy it outside and try to bring it inside that way.
And the prize is the first to get a self-driving vehicle into the marketplace and onto the roads.
That's exactly right.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
Michigan is often called one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. Proposal 2 on this November's ballot is an attempt to change that. What questions do you have about Proposal 2? We want to know. Just go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org or give us a call at 734-764-7840 with your question. That's 734-764-7840. At the beginning of a new documentary film titled Intelligent Lives, noted actor Chris Cooper explores what it really means to be intelligent and whether any attempt to measure intelligence can predict someone's value or their ability to contribute meaningfully to the world.
Our son, Jesse, had cerebral palsy and could not speak. When Jesse was 4, the neurologist told us in front of our son that he would never be intellectually normal.
Cooper and his wife disregarded the doctors, the teachers who advised sending Jesse to a special hospital school, and they fought to have him included in general education classes.
Jesse became a straight-A student in high school, wrote poetry, and he aced every one of his Latin tests.
That's Chris Cooper narrating this film called Intelligent Lives, bringing us into the lives of three young people who have cognitive disabilities, young people who are succeeding at school, in their personal lives. With us now via Skype is director Dan Habib. Dan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you. Thank you so much.
And Janice Fialka is with us. She's the mother of one of the young people featured in this film, Micah Fialka Feldman, who went to Berkeley High School in Oakland County, and as we see in the film, is now attending college classes in Syracuse, which we're going to be talking about. Janice, welcome. Good to have you back on Stateside.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Dan, what is the goal of your film? I'm wondering what you want audiences to learn from the stories of these three young people.
So, well, all my film work is around disability, and it all derives from my parenting experience of Samuel. My son Samuel just graduated from high school. He's going to college. He also uses a wheelchair and has cerebral palsy. And because he has a disability, people always have talked to him in our community, unfortunately, as being less than 18 years old. Or, you know, they'll talk to him like a five-year-old sometimes. And disability carries a very strong stigma in our society, and people are easily underestimated. So what I tried to do with this film is first get people to challenge their notions of what intelligence is and how, whether it can even be measured in any way, whether it's an IQ test or an SAT score or anything. And then I wanted to find some new people who would kind of shift the paradigm around intelligence. And Micah, I was so fortunate to meet Micah, Janice's son, because here's this young man that Janice will talk about that is shifting so many paradigms around intelligence. So I hope when people leave the film, when they see it in Michigan and elsewhere, that they have a broader perspective for how people can show their intelligence, but also their ability to just contribute in very meaningful ways to our society.
And Janice, remind us again, you've been on Stateside. Sure. It's been a little while, though, so remind us again of what was going on when Micah entered school and what you had to do.
Yes, well, Micah has what we now refer to as an intellectual disability. We used to know it as mental retardation. And he was in a self-contained classroom. And in first grade, he said very wisely, "I want to go in the same door as all my other friends." So he became the first student in Berkeley School District to be fully included with supports. And then so that continued through elementary, middle, high school. And then he wanted to open another door. And he was part of the wave of students with intellectual disabilities going to college, at which he did do. And then he ended up living in the dorm after a federal lawsuit that he brought on. And then as that sort of catapulted him into the limelight and he started speaking around the country, and ended up speaking in Syracuse, and he decided that he wanted to open that door, and he became a student in disability studies, and now, the last chapter, he now is a teaching assistant at Syracuse University.
Well, just so everybody can get a sense of Micah's irrepressible spirit, let's take a listen to a clip from Intelligent Lives. This is where we first meet Micah as he's walking across campus to his class.
In like my mind, I like never thought I would ever like move from Michigan after being there like my whole time, but it was scary the first couple of weeks, but I knew that I made a good decision because I just knew that if I lived in Michigan my whole life, I wouldn't have been able to try something new. And I knew because of me, of being Micah, I knew that it was going to work out.
And that look of confidence. Yeah. Dan, what was it that struck you about Micah?
Well, I met Micah a while back, 6-7 years ago at least, before I even started the film. And, you know, here, as Janice said, here was this young man that was very confidently living a full life and was in Syracuse and was attending courses. And, you know, all the things that Janice said are true. And it's also true that he was given an IQ score of 40 when he was a kid. And he learned that, as Janice knows, because he had to apply for adult services in Syracuse, and they wanted to see the IQ score to help him become eligible. And, he, you know, he's hilarious. In the film, Mike is so funny. He says, "Well, I Googled IQ to see what I could do and what I couldn't do." You know, and they said, "Well, I probably can't live on my own and I probably can't have a job." And here he is living on his own and has a job and doing all these things. So Micah is also one of the most socially adept people I've ever met in my life. Just his emotional intelligence is off the charts. So between all the things he's doing and the way he expressed himself, he was just a perfect person to show that people who have been systematically labeled for decades and really hundreds of years as being incapable of being included in school and society can completely thrive in those environments.
And tell us a bit about the other two young people, Nair and Naomi, whom we will meet in your film.
Right. So from the beginning, I wanted to represent high school, college, and career as the three different arenas where I wanted to show that people with intellectual disabilities can thrive. And so I met Nair because I knew about the Henderson School in Boston, which is just a wonderfully inclusive high school, public high school. And Nair has trouble communicating. He has autism. He's about 6'1". He's an African-American man. And his family is somewhat concerned about how he'll be perceived out in the community when he has maybe an unpredictable behavior because of his autism. And as we all unfortunately know, there are things happen around race in our society that can sometimes lead to quick judgments and difficult situations. So he became a very interesting kind of complex story. He's also a very gifted painter, and that's a big part of the way he expresses himself. And then Naomi, I searched for months and months and months to find that employment story. And I wanted to find someone that was transitioning from what is called a sheltered workshop, which is where people with disabilities work alongside each other in segregated settings, often for little or very low wages, but someone who is transitioning into paid, competitive, integrated employment. And after searching for many months, I found Naomi in Providence, Rhode Island. And as you see in the film, her transition story leads her into a wonderful job at a beauty school.
All three of them bring different gifts to the presence that they lend to this film. As if you've just joined us, we're talking about the film Intelligent Lives, bringing us into the lives of three young people who have cognitive disabilities, all of whom are breaking ground and succeeding in school and in their personal lives, as we talk with director Dan Habib, and also from Berkeley, Janice Fialka, whose son Micah is one of the stars of this film. Janice, how would you say, or would you say, since those early days when you were pushing to make sure that Micah was in general education classes, just like Chris Cooper was, we heard at the beginning, have things broadened and changed about how we view intelligence and the capacities of people with intellectual disabilities?
Well, you know, it's a range. Absolutely. I mean, Dan's film is certainly contributing to that. I mean, people walk away from the film going, okay, I need to broaden my perspective. There's not one way to be intelligent, and that's really important. And we see people with disabilities now in all realms of living. You can turn on the TV now, and there's programs, even comedies about families that also have a child with a disability. So there is definitely changes. You know, there's confrontations about using the R word. And we see people with disabilities working in meaningful jobs. Simultaneously, we also are struggling still as a society to be inclusive of people with disabilities. Schools still are wavering about full inclusion. Mm-hmm. That still is an issue. So we have a long way to go, but the good news in part is that people with intellectual disabilities are really in many ways at the forefront of changing the attitudes, not just the families or the educators, but you know, Micah and Naomi and Nair, they're telling their story. And, you know, and Dan has certainly been a gift to our world for that opportunity.
I just want to add something Janice said very eloquently. You know, we had a great advisor on this project named Michael Waymeyer. He's a professor in Kansas, and he describes disability as the gap between a person's abilities and the environment in which they're expected to function or thrive. So really, the disability almost becomes irrelevant if you can shrink that gap. And what I've seen in Micah's life, for instance, is his use of technology, his use of voice to text through his phone, his use of social capital, bringing friends together around him in his circle of support to think about how he can achieve his goals of dating or of graduating from school or of getting a job. He has been able to shrink that gap to the point where it's almost irrelevant in his life. I mean, it's still a factor, as Janice would say. I mean, it's still, he has his challenges, but he has such a full life because the environment around him is very supportive, and he's been able to create this structure very proactively that fills in the gaps where some of his disabilities do challenge him.
And I was really just bowled over, Dan, with some of the statistics that you hit us off right off at the top of the film, the fact that only 17% of students with intellectual disability are included in regular classrooms, 6.5 million Americans have an intellectual disability, and only 15% of them are employed.
Right. I think, you know, some people think this is a problem from the past. And didn't laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act or the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, didn't they fix all these things, all these problems? And it's not true at all. The gap is still enormous in the areas you just cited. And I'd also say, you know, one of the reasons we had Chris Cooper, the incredible Academy Award winning actor, narrate the story and share his own personal story was to kind of bring people up to the present day. And the fact that still 49 of 50 states, including Michigan, are still using intelligence testing and IQ testing as a way to determine a person's abilities or determine their, you know, intelligence. And often that comes with a number that then leads to segregation and also leads to stigma for that person for the rest of their life. So, you know, we're dealing with some very current day challenges here. This is not just ancient history.
Just to bring in Emma, Micah's sister, our daughter, who also is in the film, too, and really shows what it's like to be a teacher. She's a second grade teacher in Boston. I think one of the most powerful comments made in the film, obviously I'm a mom, is when Emma says, we just never know what people can do. And that's, I think, a really important message, certainly one that we have learned as a family as well.
Well, Intelligent Lives is going to be shown at a number of free screenings all around Michigan this month. Screenings will be followed by conversations with members of Janice's family and other people. And you can get dates, locations, times by going to intelligentlives.org, or we've got them on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Janice Fialco, you must be mighty proud of that son of yours, Micah, as we see him on the big screen in this film.
He's had a lot of good support, a lot of opportunities. Yes.
And director Dan Habib, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm excited for people to see the film, and they're going to meet Micah and see what an amazing and hilarious person he is, too. He's going to make you laugh, I promise.
Still to come, just how effective are water filters when it comes to PFAS chemicals?
There are some filters that have the capability to treat these chemicals, but not all of them.
That is in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's talk some state history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. February is Black History Month. March, Women's History Month. November is Native American Heritage Month. But right now, as we speak, we are in the middle of Hispanic Heritage Month, September 15th to October 15th. History and Heritage Months are kind of difficult because even though it's important to highlight a diverse community's history, there's a temptation to only consider it within that single designated month. With us now to talk about how we celebrate these history months, including Hispanic Heritage Month, are Delia Fernandez, Assistant Professor of History and Latino Studies at Michigan State University, as well as a recently appointed commissioner to the Michigan Historical Commission. Delia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us. And we're happy to welcome Sandra Clark, Director of the Michigan History Center and ex officio member of the Michigan Historical Commission. Great to have you, Sandra.
Great to be back with you.
Well, I'm going to start with you, Delia. The town of Niles in southwest Michigan is known as the City of Four Flags because in addition to the French, British, and U.S. flag, the city was briefly occupied by a Spanish force during the American Revolutionary War. And I think a lot of people are very familiar with what's along our, you know, California and what's along our southwest border and our southeast border. But they may be surprised to realize, yes, the Spanish presence was felt in Michigan. What's the earliest recorded mention or event of Hispanic people in Michigan?
We would have likely seen some of the more elite Latin American folks. These probably would have been Spanish descended people from places like Cuba who came into Michigan for training, for educational purposes in the late 1800s. And these would have been other professionals, doctors. But it really isn't until the 1920s that we have a sustained population of Latinos. And the first population would have been Mexicans, and in particular Mexican Americans, in the 1920s.
And what brought them here?
Labor migration, labor recruitment, two big streams. And the first is agriculture, in particular sugar beets on the east side of Michigan. Sugar beet companies advertised in Texas, offering basically free transportation to get to Michigan. They would throw in other things like housing when they got there and things like that that really attracted people there. And then the other major stream came from railroad workers. So the railroads Mexican nationals and Mexican Americans had long worked on railroads. It was very much considered Mexican labor by the late 1800s and 1900s. And so the railroads provided both transportation and labor. And so those are the two major streams that we see in that earlier time period.
Delia Fernandez is an assistant professor of history and Latino studies at MSU. Give us one of the more notable stories of Hispanic heritage in Michigan, one that really stands out to you.
So this is hard for me because I like to study history from the point of view from everyday people. A lot of the stories that I focus on are the very subtle ways that people make Michigan home for them. Hmm. And a lot of my research focuses on Grand Rapids. And so one of the big things that I like to look at is festivals and placemaking and the ways that these practices go back to at least to the 1920s in Detroit and Grand Rapids into the 40s and 50s and how Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans also who came to Michigan around that time are a very small percentage of Grand Rapids, but they were very adamant about having public festivals and sharing their culture and making sure that they were retaining their culture and being proud of it. And so I love to see the earliest photos of Mexican-American processions and Puerto Ricans joining them on horseback in mariachi garb, processionals from St. Andrew's Cathedral down to the Grand Rapids Calder Plaza. I think those are great moments where this is not necessarily a place that is home to them like the Southwest might be, but at least for one weekend a year, they can transform Grand Rapids into this place that is very familiar and very welcoming.
And as you point out, there's a twofold purpose. It is to share the culture with people that may not be familiar with it, but to also reinforce it for themselves.
Yes.
What is the reasoning behind making Hispanic Heritage Month from mid-September to mid-October?
Well, mid-September coincides with a lot of the independence dates for Latin American countries. So with Mexico, Guatemala, Costa Rica, and other countries, their independence is usually starts around September 15th, and there's a lot of dates that are within those first 2 weeks. And then the celebration, like many other ethnic history celebrations, should be about a month long, or that's kind of the trend of what it's been. And so if you start on the 15th, then we'll do 30 days until the middle of October.
Now, some might argue that perhaps relegating a group's history to that 1 month might make people feel perhaps even more marginalized. What do you see, Delia, as the importance of these heritage or history months?
Well, I can definitely see that point. I mean, ideally, we would like all of our ethnic histories, Black history, Asian American history, Latino history, incorporated in our study and appreciation of American history. There have been people who have been long fighting for this. I add myself and my students, my colleagues, who are also trying to, transform the way we think about American history to include all of these groups in our interpretation of mainstream history in the United States. But until we can get that completed, until we can make that a very real possibility, these months serve as a period of time where we make this a priority for people to learn about these particular cultures, these particular people. This is a very common refrain about African-American history, but the month that is dedicated to these particular histories is more for the outside community than it is for Latinos themselves or African-Americans themselves. A lot of those groups are trying hard to maintain and their history and celebrate it all year round, but this is one time that we can make sure that other people are engaging with our history and viewing both the struggles and the contributions that these groups have had.
Sandra Clark, the Michigan History Center, how do you feel the Michigan History Center has affected or impacted the way all groups of people can see themselves in Michigan's history?
Well, we have made that a goal, but I have to say, in all honesty, it is not a goal we've always achieved to the level that we should. And we're really focusing now on trying to do a much, much better job. We've included Latinos in some of our special exhibits. There are references to them in our permanent exhibits, but they tend to be to the traditional concept of people working in agriculture and things like that. And when you get a little deeper into it, you realize there's a much broader story to tell. And our challenge right now is really rounding out that story and discovering it, as Delia says, making it part of our everyday look at life in Michigan.
And what's the purpose of the Michigan Historical Commission, Sandra?
The Historical Commission is an advisory body. It's appointed by the governor. They have one major function, which is the Michigan Historical Marker Program. They actually approve all the texts that show up on those green and gold markers. And they act as a sounding board for our staff as we are developing programs. Sometimes they do things, special things like Delia's doing today, of actually helping us with some of our programs. So they work with us and can play a very important role sometimes in how we plan things for the future.
Why was it important to have someone of Hispanic descent appointed to be on the commission?
Well, I think we've learned, we've done a lot of work with Native Americans in the last 4 years. And I think in doing that, we all have learned that we can research and research, but we can't see things through the eyes of people from other cultures. And if we're really going to do this right and not just say what we think we see, but let other people speak about the America and the Michigan that they know, we're not doing our job. And so to have a Latina on the commission means that we've got a voice there all the time, not just if it's a topic that we think there might be a Latina perspective on, but no matter what we're doing. And that's priceless in what we're trying to achieve in the long run.
Important perspectives as we are in the middle of this month-long celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month. A big thanks to the Michigan History Center Director, Sandra Clark, and to Delia Fernandez, Assistant Professor of History and Latino Studies at Michigan State University. It was great to have you on Stateside.
Thanks so much. It was always a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
And now we continue with our series on PFAS contamination around Michigan as we seek the answers to the questions you have asked. Today, water filters.
My name is Donna, and I'm from Oscoda, Michigan. We have not got straight answers from any department. Any governmental department has left us with questions. I mean, they tell you the filters for your drinking water are all you need. But then I read reports that say that the filters they're using do not remove all the PFAS.
Well, let's turn for some answers to Rick Andrew, Director of Global Development for Water Systems at NSF International. It's an independent global public health organization based in Ann Arbor. Rick, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Cynthia.
And so just to set the stage for everyone, it's worth noting NSF was founded in 1944?
Yes, 1944, and right here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So we're kind of a homegrown organization that's very, very happy to help the people of Michigan.
And I know starting in the 1970s, NSF helped develop the American National Standards for any materials and products that come in contact with drinking water. So yours is indeed the right group to be chosen by the state to review PFAS filters. So, Rick, what is the review process like? How do you go about it, and what is it you're looking for in a filter?
Sure. What we want to do really is make sure these filters are working as the manufacturer claims. So in this case, we want to test them specifically with PFOA and PFOS to make sure that the filter is treating those chemicals effectively when it's being used by people who are counting on it to provide clean, safe drinking water for their families.
And when we should also remind everybody, PFOA and PFOS are in that PFAS family.
Yes, they are the two most commonly studied of that family of chemicals, and also they're two that we have health advisory levels for. So that health advisory level helps us set a limit for how much can be left in the water after the filter has treated it.
So back to Donna's question, are filters designed to remove the chemicals in the PFAS family, or do they just limit the amount?
Right. And it's not all filters. There are some filters that have the capability to treat these chemicals, but not all of them. So that's why it's really important to check to make sure they are tested and certified by NSF. And you can find information about that on the product itself or on our website at nsf.org. But the ones that are engineered and designed and manufactured to serve that function are really rigorously tested, not to remove necessarily all of it, but under our test protocol, they have to remove at least 95% of the PFOA and PFOS that's present in the drinking water.
So what should it get to? What should be the level of PFOA and PFOS?
Well, the level that we're using is based on that U.S. EPA health advisory level, and it's 70 parts per trillion. So really a low amount because these chemicals are, you know, they have certain chemical properties that can make them not so great to be drinking. So it's down all the way to 70 parts per trillion.
But I know there are those who feel that level, the EPA's acceptable level of 70 parts per trillion, is too high. So let's say someone wants a stronger filter and wants to really knock it down further. Is that out there?
Well, one of the things that we do is we keep an eye on these kinds of issues in terms of new developments in the science and new developments in regulatory levels. And if we see that that bar is lowering or the landscape is shifting, we'll pull together our technical experts and relook at the way we're doing the testing, and we'll make adjustments.
But is there such a thing as a stronger filter that would reduce that level to much lower than that 70 parts per trillion, or is that not available yet?
Well, there may be. We just wouldn't know it based on the way we're doing the testing.
Got it. What are some of these special challenges in filtering out PFOA and PFOS, these PFAS contaminants?
Well, part of it is the very low levels. You know, once you get down into parts per trillion levels, that's a very low concentration of the contaminant to be in the drinking water. So just doing the testing takes really specialized equipment and instrumentation to carefully control the test, to really accurately measure how much is being put in the water to challenge the filter, and then accurately measure how much is still remaining in the water afterwards. So it's a very sophisticated type of technology and laboratory that's required to do this testing.
Are there filters that multitask, Rick, that effectively filter out PFAS, lead, arsenic, radium? How does that work?
Yes. In fact, some of the filters that we test have capability to reduce numerous contaminants because they incorporate multiple technologies. They may have activated carbon. They may use reverse osmosis. They may have additional treatment technologies incorporated into them. So they get pretty sophisticated. And really, the way consumers can kind of check on these things is to look at our listings at our website on nsf.org. We have all the filters and manufacturers listed there, including all the contaminants that we've tested them to be effective at treating.
When we think of the many headlines coming out of Flint with the lead that leached into the water there, and now we've got concerns about PFAS chemicals in the water, chemically, are there different challenges in clearing one out versus the other?
Yes, absolutely. You know, with the lead, one of the big concerns there is that some of it can be in particle form and some of it can be dissolved. So the filter really needs to be able to treat both forms of lead, both the dissolved and the particles. So that takes a special technology there. And then with the PFOA, PFOS, those compounds are very different. They're organic compounds that are structured very differently from lead. So it's really a completely different type of treatment technology that's needed to treat those effectively.
Rick, we also got a question from a listener about disposing these filters that remove these PFOA and PFOS chemicals. Are they safe to throw in the trash, or should you take other measures because of the PFAS toxicity?
You know, it's interesting. The way these work is that the chemicals in the drinking water would rather attach to the filter than stay in the drinking water. They're chemically attracted, and so they end up bonding to that filter and kind of coming out of the drinking water. So when those filters are put into a landfill, it's pretty unlikely that they would detach themselves then from the filter and go back into some kind of liquid that's inside the landfill. So it's pretty safe to assume that those chemicals are going to stay bonded to the filter. You know, and interestingly enough, some of the manufacturers of the filters now actually have recycling programs. So with some of these companies and products, consumers can actually ship them back in, and the manufacturer will have those spent filters recycled into a number of different things. It could be materials for constructing roads or other things. So just something to throw out there and for people to think about.
And just, again, just to recap, for anyone who is looking for some unbiased guidance in choosing a drinking water filter to reduce any contaminant, the website is nsf.org, and you've got a list of what's available and it's been tested?
Yes, absolutely. We update that listing every day, so it's completely current as to which filters have been tested to treat which contaminants. It's pretty searchable, and people can definitely check it out for themselves and see what they can find.
Rick Andrew, Director of Global Development for Water Systems at NSF International. Rick, thank you so much for taking time to answer our filter questions.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.